this bill 53, has Obama seen that legislation at all, and has there been any response from him or his administration?
Well, President Obama and I, we're not on speaking terms right now. We were playing basketball a few weeks ago and I dunked on him. And he won't return any of my text messages now. It's terrible. Now, unfortunately, has Obama seen the legislation? I doubt it. Someone on his national security team, maybe. I will tell you that the legislation is still active. But what we're really focused on is the funding in the House bill. And that did get noticed. Buck McKeon, who is the chair of the House Armed Service Committee, he's a Republican from the Midwest, actually tried to remove the protections for the funding. And it's not because he took up a beef with the actual bill or the concept, pardon me, of a study group. It's because it's a threat to the DOD's mode of operating. Having an independent bipartisan group evaluate what's been happening in Afghanistan might be counter to, might be a counter narrative that emerges from the DOD's narrative. So it's kind of a threat. $1 million, just to put that in context, the DOD's number, and I use the DOD, Department of Defense, and Pentagon interchangeably, so they're kind of the same thing to me. The DOD's number is $1 million per one troop per year in Afghanistan. $1 million per troop per year. That's probably more money than I'll make in my lifetime, especially working for nonprofits. I tell you, it's not very lucrative. But $1 million for a study group is so nominal. I mean, in the funding bill, $650 billion, it's a rounding error. It's literally, it's like nothing. So hopefully, won't be able to maintain funding, and then President Obama will definitely know that the bill, made it through.
Okay, so we have one, two, and three. Yes.
So now, how can we get that source for the $1 million per troop per year?
Take that one out.
I've told many people that figure and we do not believe it. Isn't the place it's written, I hate to say New York Times, but someplace where we can zero it out and I can just hand it to them?
I believe it was Eugene Robinson who wrote the Washington Post article using that statistic, but I'm not positive. I know it was the Washington Post, but I'm not sure if it was actually him. So it is. I'm sure Google is an amazing thing. And I'm sure you could find, if you Google 1 million per troop per year in Washington Post, I'm sure it will come up.
Hi.
What's your name, man?
Colin.
Which is Chicago Security. No, I'm just kidding.
So you mentioned like a dominant narrative within the military coming out of D.C. So in my studies within the military, I've really not seen any type of consistent narrative. I've seen colonels, like that group of Colonel John J. Deal.
Oh yeah.
He's like the biggest critic of counterinsurgency and the lack of strategy. And you go to Small Wars Journal, which is really active military community, and you really see no consistency with regards to the outlook in Afghanistan. So what do you believe is the narrative that's coming out of the Pentagon? And furthermore, just that's very important. Yeah. What do you believe the narrative is?
So I totally agree with you that there are actors in the Pentagon. There's a small community, and the guy's name is escaping right now. I'll come up with it. But he wrote the book Dark Heart, which is about the first operation in the Bush administration in Pakistan that went wrong. And he's another really outspoken critic. He's a colonel in the Army. He's still on active duty. And he catches all kinds of flack. So there are those actors, definitely within the Pentagon. When I say that there is a dominant narrative, I'm definitely referring to when it was Gates, Secretary Gates, and Admiral Mullen. Now it's Dempsey and Leon Panetta. I'm talking about the figureheads at the Pentagon itself, the people who testify to the House Armed Service Committee, the Senate Armed Service Committee, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. When those testimonies take place, the people they send, Michelle Flournoy, who's the Undersecretary of Defense, all of these guys, and now CNAS, I saw you laugh when I said that. CNAS is actually Michelle Flournoy's project, you know? It's totally, she's 100% with that. And, you know, Nagel himself, I don't mind too much personally, but I don't agree with him a whole lot. But there is definitely a narrative among the political leadership in the Pentagon that the war is improving, and it fluctuates. You know, Mullen, who was on his way out, coincidentally decided that he would criticize the ISI and start to say that some of the metrics weren't improving, which was interesting in his most recent testimony, on his kind of, I guess it was his farewell testimony, really. But when you look at the consistency in the testimonies of these higher officials to the committees who oversee the war, to the committees who write the policy and fund the wars, there is definitely a consistency. Even if it's just, we need more time. Things are never going badly enough to stop what the Pentagon's doing. They might be going badly, but only because they need more money or they need more troops or something like that. But the general narrative, in my view, is we're around the corner, and there are tons of quotes from all of these testimonies where each of these people that I've named will say, we're turning a corner. We're turning the corner. I think we've turned so many corners, it's pretty clear we're in a maze right now, you know? But realistically, it's true that there's that kind of overarching narrative. And I can send you some of the testimonies if you want me to. I'd be happy to do that. Can everyone still hear me? All right, this is good. Okay.
I just kind of wonder if there's any kind of cohesive community that can form in such a divided country. Now, well, it's not so divided, but it's the picture that I'm getting is that it's fragmented, what's the word I'm looking for?
But it's mess.
A mess. Well, but it's always been a mess. You know, I mean, pretty much the history, it's kind of a messy country. And I'm just wondering, you know, is there kind of a cohesive community someplace that can kind of pick up things?
I think those communities exist. You might not hear about them very often, but there's not always honesty in reporting either. I think the veterans community has been very vibrant. I'm a member of several veterans organizations that have been doing this work since before the war started. And we're not always in an absolute agreement when we talk about these things.
Afghans. Which is so chaotic. Yeah, how the Afghans can pick up the society and carry it on. Well, certainly nobody believes that Karzai is, you know, a source of community.
That's a very good question, and one with a very complicated answer. I think I certainly met with Afghans on my trip that were very capable and very smart. And there are Afghans that exist in the government that are very capable and very smart. You can look at our government, and you may not agree with leaders in a certain political party, and you might think they're all crazy, but there are still people who are very smart and very capable. That is definitely true of Afghans, and it's certainly true of Afghan civil society. Are there credibility gaps? Yes. Is there corruption? Yes. Are there issues? Absolutely. I would say that we have in this country some of those same issues. I think that the problem hasn't been that Afghans have been given the keys and haven't opened the door. The problem has been that Afghans have been prevented from even getting close to the door. And in a lot of ways, U.S. allies, the warlords, and to some degree Karzai and his regime, have been the gatekeepers. So I think, yes, I'll put it to you this way. In 2014, there's an election. The best thing that the U.S. can do and work for right now is to ensure that that is a free and fair election. And when I say U.S., I mean U.S. and international community. And it will be very hard, and it may not be perfect, and it will definitely be messy. But when Afghans vote for their new president, 2014, because according to the Afghan constitution, President Karzai cannot serve another term. He has made statements saying that he will honor that. If he does, and if there is this election that ushers in a new Afghan government, then it will be for Afghans to decide. And I think ultimately anything we do in Afghanistan must be Afghan-led. I should say that as well. So the answer to your question is yes, I think those elements exist. You certainly don't hear about them all the time, but without doubt they're there. I want to add to that.
I mean, nation building through military deployment. That's an interesting question. Who would send it? Who would provide it? Like, who would give the counterinsurgency forces? And I probably wasn't clear enough in describing counterinsurgency because I've been thinking about it as a military strategy, but of course, the way I got interested in studying counterinsurgency was by the fact that I just published a book on insurgencies, which are otherwise known as revolutions, right? That's one of the more interesting moments in the counterinsurgency manual where they define the difference between an insurgency and a revolution. And a revolution is something that happens spontaneously when everyone in the country just automatically stands up and decides they want a regime change. An insurgency is when a small group of people start organizing in order to achieve a regime change. Right? So, I mean, if you noticed in the press coverage about Arab Spring, they never called any of those movements an insurgency. Right? Because according to our dominant narrative, insurgencies are bad and they need a counterinsurgency. Instead, those were popular movements. So I actually believe America needs an insurgency.
I think that's what I meant.
My answer would be no. Only because I think our society has been militarized to a degree that is extremely unhealthy and causes us to dehumanize other people and view fellow human beings as other or different because maybe their culture is different, their societies are different, their language is different. And I think that's tragic. And I think if we are 7 billion people living on one tiny little rock, we're gonna have to learn how to get along or we're gonna destroy each other and the planet we live on. So I would be in favor of something a little less military oriented myself.
Can I ask you as a follow-up to that?
Yeah, there we go.
So do you think that there's a connection between the kind of acrimony that you see in Washington and the militarization of our politics?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, there's no doubt. One of the things we try really hard to do at SCNL is not use militarized language. So a lot of the groups that we work with will say, well, who are we gonna target in Congress? And we're like, well, we have a swing list. You know, we try not to use these kinds of terms. But without doubt, in our politics, I mean, you don't have to watch too many presidential debates or listen to too many ads before you hear things like, you know, target, or you hear, you know, the word campaign itself is a French military term, you know. Without doubt, the language used in kind of across the board is very militarized. And it's a challenge for me. I must admit that I'm not the best at not using militarized language, but Get the Bastard is still acceptable, so I'm still working on it.
I have a quick question to ask you guys. I'm wondering, is it possible to build infrastructure that's culturally relevant to Afghans? In other words, does it have to be infrastructure according to the Western democracy? Like, why does a Western democracy have to be the measure of success? And this is addressed to both President Rye and
you take that first?
You were just there. So you
okay. You know, that's a very good question. I think in parts of Afghanistan, a Western-style democracy could work. I think in most of Afghanistan, a Western-style democracy is not advantageous to the cultural, historic presence of governing structures. It's in much of Afghanistan, particularly in the south and east, they have systems. And if you look at the structure of the Afghan government itself, it's not particularly democratic. You know, you have an elected parliament, and you have an elected president, and the governors are appointed. Many of the mayors in the major cities are appointed. Many of the district leaders and things like that are all appointed. So it's not a particularly democratic structure anyway. I think ultimately, it's going to be for Afghans to decide. I think we're at a point now where if we're looking to leave and withdraw the majority of our support by 2014, that we don't really have a chance to say, okay, things went bad, let's start over. And I don't think we should. I think we should work for a free and fair election, because it's the structure that's in place now, in the hopes that once Afghans vote and have a new government, they can decide for themselves what works best without foreign interference, be it Pakistani, Indian, U.S., Iranian, whatever.
I think one of the more striking things, I'm glad Matt brought up the disconnect between reality on the ground and rhetoric, and I think you see this a lot in the way we measure progress and the way we even attempt to measure democracies. I mean, we have these very simplistic ideas of, oh, if there's an election, then that must mean there's a democracy. I've been doing research on ideas about the rule of law, right? We actually spend millions of dollars every single year bolstering up, quote unquote, the rule of law around the world. USAID has special programs, and you look at what they do, what bolstering the rule of law means. It means they go and have workshops with law students about the importance of understanding private property. Right? And then if they get good attendance, then that means they can say that the rule of law is being bolstered in this country. And so even just the whole ideal of Western democracy, I don't think we have a very good sense of what that really means. And it's become a sort of imaginary benchmark that we use to either beat up regimes we're unhappy with, or use to, like for instance, Egypt, what a great example. That was a democracy. So I'm very, very cautious about using that as a benchmark for development and understanding how different governments are actually being run.
If you have a pen, write this down. Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Yeah.
Read it.
Yeah, good book.
There were two questions.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about all the other actors that are in Afghanistan. Indian, Pakistani, Iran, China, Stans,
sure.
Et
cetera. Sandra is hosting me while I'm here. So we had this very vibrant discussion over dinner and wine about the other actors. So thank you for asking the question. Yes, they're one of the complexities of the conflict in Afghanistan, one of the reasons why military strategies don't work in Afghanistan, and I would argue in other places as well, but certainly in Afghanistan, is there are layers to the conflict. Think of the conflict as a cake. On the bottom layer, there is conflict within Afghanistan, within Afghan society. There's ethnic conflict, religious conflict, religious and ethnic tensions There are ethnic, especially ethnic tensions, that's one of the biggest. On top of that, you have the regional players and the regional by proxy wars. And the regional players, the people in the region who are contributing to the conflict, there's a kind of a cold proxy war going on between the Indians and the Pakistanis, for example. Indians have a lot of economic interests in Pakistan. One of the most recent examples is a very large deposit of iron ore in Bamiyan province, which is right next to Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. And that deposit's gonna take 5 or 10 years to actually build up and be able to mine, but the Indians are very interested in it. The Pakistanis are terrified of Indian influence in their backyard, which is Afghanistan. So the Indians who have forged an alliance with the Northern Alliance, now known as the United Front in the north of the country, are really doing is essentially fighting out a political and economic proxy war, and in sometimes, in some cases, an actual war with the Pakistanis, particularly the ISI and the Pakistani Taliban, Tehrik-i Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban. And these kind of proxy wars that are happening on top of the layers of conflict really are what drives much of the instability. And the U.S. presence, the U.S. funding these anti-Taliban Mujahideen warlords, the U.S. alliance with the ISI and the Pakistanis, the U.S. alliance with India as well, have only exacerbated a lot of these proxy conflicts happening on top. Iran also has a lot of influence in the west of the country, in Herat, for example. About 80% of the Afghan population is Sunni Muslim, and about 20% is Shia Muslim. It's actually 19% Shia Muslim. And the Shias, Iran is a predominantly Shia country, it has a Shia government. So the Iranians actually are attempting to gain influence with that Shia minority. So there's that a level of religious tension happening. You've got China, who is buying large gold deposits all around the country and investing in their mining interests. They're not so much a party to the proxy war. They're happy to let everybody else fight it out and just take the gold, you know? But what this really comes down to is you have a conflict where the regional political settlement involves all countries around Afghanistan except for Afghanistan. And many of the Afghans we spoke with actually said the only people who don't belong at the table in the regional political settlement are Afghans. Everyone else is fighting in our country. So it's a kind of an interesting take on what folks are saying, but these layers of conflict happening on top of the war, I didn't even mention the stands, Uzbekistan in particular. The U.S. is looking to move its supply route from the very embattled supply road in Pakistan that leads from the port of Karachi, which has its own set of political violence happening, up through to Afghanistan, to Uzbekistan. And Uzbekistan has a long-standing human rights abuse record. And the U.S. is looking to raise economic sanctions so that it can set up a supply chain through Uzbekistan. I mean, that's where we are 10 years later. We are actually, in the name of protecting our freedom and democracy and all things that are just and true and, you know, good to our hearts, actually waffling on our own moral convictions. It's really absurd if you think about it. And on top of that, borrowing from the Chinese so that we can have a strategic base to counter Chinese influence. I mean, how does that make any sense? So.
That's a lot to swallow.
I actually wanted to amplify just a bit on her question, and I think specifically focus on two things that our government, our, maybe I should say our shadow government more than our nominal government, is really interested, both in the Middle East and in Central Asia and Afghanistan. They want permanent, a lot of the military and a lot of the big movers and shakers, economic movers and shakers, want permanent military garrisons in both the Persian Gulf. Some of them are more, they like the Persian Gulf better, and some of them like Afghanistan better, Central Asia. So it depends on whether you're on the Brzezinski or you know, the other side of that fence. And they're not gonna get out of there, the military importance of oil. They're going to claim just one excuse or another for as long as they could possibly get away with it, just to have a military presence there for their reasons. and also the opium supply, because actually most of the Western, certainly Wall Street, and most of the Western banking and stock market and financial institutions would crumble if the illegal drug trade were stopped. And so whoever is in charge in Afghanistan, at this point they've been producing 90-odd% of the world's opium. Unless we can completely, you know, rework our banking and financial systems, they're going to have to keep the heroin trade going. And nobody ever talks about this.
Yeah.
But these are like imperative realities given the system that we have. And you were talking about the study group, and I guess my question would be, I don't know, maybe it sounds a little bit cynical, but I would like to know, is there anybody going to bring these issues and the other regional issues that you had brought up with Pakistan and all of the other countries fighting over Afghanistan?
That's the hope. I mean, ultimately, that's what we want to see come out of this, is an evaluation of all of the elements that are contributing to the ongoing conflict and the regional instability, including the U.S. military presence. So, without doubt, that's the hope. I mean, the military and this idea of strategic bases, I believe that. I do believe that there are elements within the political elite, within our kind of our military elite, that would love to have strategic bases in the Middle East. And look, we have over 1,000 bases around the world. The world itself is divided up into command centers, CENTCOM being the one that governs the Middle East. There's no doubt in my mind that the military wants to have these strategic bases. Not the military, to say the whole military, but certainly elements within it. And that's just completely and totally crazy. I mean, the idea, even Secretary Gates, I think, said it best in one of his farewell speeches. He went on that whole speaking tour, and he said the next Secretary of Defense that recommends a ground war into Central Asia ought to have their head examined. I mean, this is the Secretary of Defense saying, don't ever do this again. It is insane. So yeah, there might be that, but I think there are many more practical people that work in the government and on the outside who realize just the pure insanity. And not only that, how much this thing costs, not only in human lives, but also in dollars. I mean, we're talking, according to Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Vilmes, economists from Harvard and Columbia, respectively, $4 to $6 trillion in the long run. To put that in the context, our federal debt right now is $14 trillion. So almost half of our federal debt, you know, essentially doubling the debt in the long term because of cost of care and interest on the debt. It's really staggering. Do you want to add to that?
We actually talked about this over dinner.
Yeah.
And that's my hope, right, that our government is going to be so cash-strapped, they're going to be forced to reconsider some of their defense policies, but you know, we'll see.
So we're actually going to take one more question, and then we have an announcement.
Two more questions.
Okay, so two more questions, and we have an announcement. We're going to conclude our panel for tonight. So we have one.
I'm really sad that I missed almost the whole lecture part of this.
You missed all the best parts.
I couldn't find the building. But I am a Muslim Afghan American here in America, and I'm just like, I was born and raised here, but my parents were born in Afghanistan. And I'm studying Islamic studies at Daytona College, the first Muslim university here in America. I don't know if anybody knows about it. But like, I know an imam back home from, I come from Virginia, and he went on a trip with the State Department to Afghanistan, and he like went and talked around to the different youth groups and like the universities and the colleges and talked to the youth about Islam in America and what they perceive. And pretty much the discrepancy of time between news from here in Afghanistan is like 10 to 20 days. Like, they have no idea what's going on here. And he told me the military needs to get out as soon as possible.
Yep.
But the development work and the social work that is doing there is really essential, and we really need to keep that there. So as an Afghan American here in America, and looking to be a Muslim leader here, like, what kind of, because I feel like we can't tell the Afghans what to do in Afghanistan, because we're not in that position, so we don't know what will be the best solution for them. So we, like you said, we have to let the Afghans choose what's best for them because they're there. But at the same time, as a white American sitting in Capitol Hill, it is very difficult for me to tell what someone suffering in Kandahar or someone can do to fix their country.
Yeah.
It's not gonna work like that. But at the same time, I think if the Afghans and the Muslims here in America, at least particularly the Afghans, if they could somehow connect and we could get them involved in some social work, at least the Muslim Afghan leaders, and try to and the youth, because there are people who really want to make a difference and want to help them out, but they don't know what they can do. And it's we go around and we try to make a difference, but if we could somehow, the Afghan youth and the Muslim leaders here in America could somehow cooperate with the State Department, and they could do some social work and development work, and try to close that gap, because they have no idea that they're even practicing Muslims here in America. They have no idea about what's going on here. So if we could bridge that gap and allow Afghans here to connect with Afghans there and see if that could somehow add to the social development.
Well, thank you for that. And I just want to highlight how important it is to mention the Afghan youth. The life expectancy in Afghanistan is around 45. 90% of the country is under the age of 35. 60% of the country is under the age of 18. It is a country that will be led by the generation that is suffering through the worst of this war right now. So it's really critically important to take in the youth and that objective opinion into account. I have actually worked with a number of Afghans that are here, Muslim Afghans, working in the U.S. expats, mostly actually based in this area, but also some in Virginia. A guy named Ali, I can't remember his last name, maybe you know him, I don't know. My friend in Kansas, maybe you don't know. There is certainly a disconnect. I don't know how to bridge that, personally, I really don't. But I think it's important, and I'm glad you highlighted it.
Thank you. I was following all your comments and things, and it seemed to me that there were sort of three things, or two things, and then sort of a question that stood out to me. So the first thing that really seems to be crucial is this question of information, because like you were saying, there's this huge information gap between what is actually happening on the ground and what people who, for example, are in the military have experienced in the military, what people who have been working with populations know about what's happening, what people people who study this stuff, and what in general public is happening. And I see this in the classroom every day, but it also, in the general public, there's too little information and too much misinformation and purposeful disinformation that's being spread. So I would also urge you all to look at the Cost of War Project, which the Watson Institute at Brown University has launched recently, really trying to get at not just the economic cost, but also the personal, the human cost of the war, and try to use your social networks to spread this information around. There's a lot of information out there, it just needs to get to the right places. And then the second part of it, and which is something that I'm personally interested in because I do research on how the way we frame events in particular ways, for example, through security language, really matters in the way that we respond to these events. So this idea that the narrative has to change, that we have to get away from the generally militarized language, but also the way in which the Pentagon, and I know there are huge discrepancies between some very critical people who are often within the military and the Pentagon as an institution, and sort of speaking sort of the Pentagon talk. So changing narratives, finding ways in which you can work through the narrative that exists, displace that narrative, right, and then bring in a new narrative. I think that's crucially important, and that's something that everybody can do in their everyday conversations. And then the question that I really have is, because the subtitle for the event today is Exit Strategies, right?
Yeah.
And you talked about this a little bit when you talked about creating a study group, is this question of exiting without losing face, because I think that's really important, right? To just kind of give up, hold down the tents and leave would be A, admitting defeat, and B, sort of doing what the Soviet Union and in some way the US did in 89 and might lead to the exact same follow-up. So if we're talking about exit strategies beyond, the study, what are some other ideas that you can come up with?
Next one, I'll start and you can finish.
Sure.
I talked with someone about 3 weeks ago who also just came back from Afghanistan, and I was haunted by two things she said, and I think that they point towards some ideas about an exit strategy. You just mentioned the importance of the youth, and she talked about the really major importance of elders in the countryside who can remember a world before there was war, before the Soviet invasion. And she talked about trying to highlight their voices to change the narrative of what was possible in Afghanistan, that there needed to be some kind of resurrection of an indigenous memory of what peace looked like, right? And I find that really interesting and very compelling. The other thing she mentioned is she was in Helmand Province, and she pointed out that some of the female engagement teams could just move into old housing that had been built by the Peace Corps in the 1960s, that there were little, you know, cement block housing that looked like West Hollywood scattered around, and that there was a cohort of Peace Corps volunteers who did a lot of development work in the 1960s and then came back and are now populating an Afghan studies program at University of Nebraska. And so she was suggesting that we also reach out to people, that it's important to remember that development work was happening before the war, right? And that there might be some other wisdom that can be gathered from people before the more recent disasters have befallen us. I tend to go back in time and try and find forks in the road and places where we could have taken another path and try and rescue some resources from those moments. So that's my idea.
So for those interested in Cost of War, it's costofwar.org is the website. There's also a costofwar.com, which is also really interesting. Doesn't have quite that human element to it, but it'll tell you how much you've spent on the war in your state, in your city, in your town. It'll actually break it down for you. And not only that, but it'll tell you what the alternatives are. So kind of a cool resource, especially for those who are maybe writing papers about this sort of thing. In terms of exit strategies, yes. There's kind of a US political exit strategy, you know, like we need Congress to actually pass an exit strategy bill to force the administration to actually adopt a strategy that makes sense. But in terms of what should happen on the ground in Afghanistan, which to me is far more important, I shouldn't say that too loud, my boss is in my ear, but what should happen on the ground in Afghanistan? For, you know, the two overarching things, we need a political transition strategy and we need an economic transition strategy. It's not enough to just rely on security. If you don't have a government with the institutional capacity to actually govern the country, whatever way that looks, it doesn't matter how much security you transition. When you're building up a military that's around 370,000 by 2014, and you have a very weak civilian government, you're funding and arming warlords. I mean, it's a recipe for civil war. So within that, the U.S. needs to weaken the warlords or even completely disempower them. And there are a number of ways that can be done, moving them to different provinces or, you know, maybe making them come back to America where we got them from, that sort of thing. But that's one of the things within that. But also strengthening and funding key transition ministries. Ministry of the Interior, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Women's Affairs, all of these ministries that are key to building civil society capacity and building other capacities of the country of Afghanistan must be funded. Now, that is problematic in a way because there is issues of legitimacy and corruption. But we can't throw out the whole system. This is what we have. We have to work with what we have. We are much better off trying to convene an international corruption monitoring task force that is not held accountable by President Karzai, but held accountable by the international community that's part Afghan, part foreign. Something like that to oversee some of these ministry funds. It's not the DOD, it's not the US government, it's not the Afghan government, may be a way to flesh out some of those issues. It's not gonna be perfect, it will be messy, but the alternative is gonna be much worse. So that's one of the things I think that should happen. Key to all of this is a regional political settlement, and this is probably the toughest because it involves getting the Pakistanis and the Indians at the table and solving Kashmir. That really is playing out in Afghanistan. A lot of that is playing out in Afghanistan. The hardest thing to do, if it could be done, it would have been done a long time ago, but there's no time like the present, especially with the escalation of violence between Afghanistan, between Pakistan and India. It's critical, it's absolutely critical. The U.S. needs to open diplomatic channels with Iran. The things we've seen happening lately are just an indication of the fact that the lack of diplomatic channels are really, really costly and problematic and cause the U.S. to be reactionary. When you have Eric Holder saying, we're going to hold Iran accountable for this and that, when they don't even have a substantiated case, it's pretty crazy. And it's a pretty clear indication that relations between the two countries aren't in a place where we can actually be a part of this regional political settlement. Then there's also like the Afghan political settlement, which involves giving the Taliban or the insurgent groups an address somewhere in Dubai. Turkey's been mentioned. A place where they can go without fear of being killed or captured, and they can negotiate. So essentially, the U.S. creates the space and then steps back and lets it happen. And a political settlement between the Afghan government and the Taliban is not good enough. It needs to be a political settlement between Afghan civil society, the Afghan government, and insurgent groups and such as the Taliban. Absent that, it's really hard to imagine a positive solution or a positive outcome to the U.S. drawdown. The other and the final thing that I'll leave everyone with is an economic transition strategy. And the really critical, and I don't have all the answers for this, I am not an economist, but 97% of Afghanistan's gross domestic product is derived from international donors. 97%, according to the World Bank. Completely unsustainable. Afghanistan imports about 200 million eggs a year. I mean, Afghans can raise chickens, right? I mean, why are they importing so many eggs? But there's also energy, for example. 70% of Afghanistan's energy is imported. It's very reliant on the countries around it, and that's not sustainable. And you also, you know, the Afghan government itself, and here's a little hint at the problem within the U.S. strategy of transferring just security. The Afghan government annual revenue is right around $1.5 billion. The annual budget of the Afghan government is right around $1 billion. The cost of the salaries and benefits alone for the Afghan National Security Forces are around $6 billion. $6 billion. Several times more than the entire revenue of the Afghan government. So having no real political or real economic base such a dependent economy is not sustainable in the long term for Afghanistan. It's part of what you alluded to, the U.S. military leaving, but other support not leaving. It's going to be, I mean, this is a 20 or 30 year thing, and it's the situation that we have, and I personally care about Afghans. I care about Afghanistan, and I don't want to see the country slide into civil war or incurable violence. I think we're at a critical time. There are solutions, or there are possible solutions. It will be messy, it won't be perfect, but I think we can do it, and the first step is removing the military presence.